X's for Podcast is brought to you by the Cage Club Network. So for all things movies, music, media, comics, and more, check out Cage Club at cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me. Hey everybody, and welcome back to X's for Podcast, the show where we take a look at the adventures of Marvel's Merry Mutants week after week through their many titles. I'm Nico, and you guys can find me on Twitter and Instagram at NicoAction. That's N-I-C-O-A-C-T-I-O-N. And today, we have an amazing episode for you. We're going to be covering Cable number 7, as well as the Union number 2, a King in Black tie-in. But before we can get to that, David Baldon stopped by our studios, virtually speaking, to have a conversation with us on his process, X-Factor, his collaborations, and more. This was an incredible experience for myself, Rod, and Arturo, where we got to ask one of our favorite artists about the way he creates the art that we care so much about, whether it's his relationship with the characters prior to this story, or it's the detailed description of how the looks of the characters came to be. This interview was so insightful and just so much fun to be a part of, and we hope you guys enjoy it too. Hey everybody, and welcome back to X's for Podcast, where we take a look at the adventures of Marvel's Merry Mutants week after week. I'm Nico, and you guys can find me at NicoAction, N-I-C-O-A-C-T-I-O-N.
Hi, I'm Rod. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Rod, the.
And I'm Arturo, that's Mr. Toybox on Twitter and Instagram.
And today we have with us a very special guest, and it's one of those things that the magic of Twitter that makes these things happen, and we couldn't be more excited. I want to welcome David Baldon to the show, everybody, artist of X Factor. Hey, David.
Hey, Nico, how are you doing? Thank you so much for having me.
We could not be more excited. We are such big fans of your work with Leah Williams over on X Factor and so much of your work leading up to that. It's just been so exciting to see these characters come to life under this new and exciting pencil. And I know I'm really excited. How has drawing X-Men been for you?
Exhausting. it's a group book. Those are exhausting. They always are, but really exciting because, you know, working with Leah is great. We have a lot of fun together, working together. And I mean, I was looking forward to work with her even before Gwenpool series. And I was lucky enough to get to work with her there, and getting the chance to continue our collaboration on X Factor was great. It's exhausting but exciting.
It has to be. I mean, you guys churn out so many pages of this book every month. Now, Rod, I know you actually had some questions about the partnership and how it came to be.
Yes, I sure did. So actually, David, hi.
Hi.
First, I want to say I loved your Spirits of Vengeance art on that.
Oh, thank you very
book.
Much.
That was spectacular. Spectacular book. Spectacular art. So my first question is, how did you and Leah become the team for X Factor? Was it because y'all worked on Gwenpool so well together?
Oh, I guess so. I don't really know the background of the whole story of getting the team together, the whole thing. But I do know that we were finishing, we must have been on at the beginning of issue 5 of Gwenpool, might be. And I got an email from Jordan DeWitt offering the project. And I guess it had to do with our, you know, rapport on Gwenpool, an entirely different animal from X Factor, of course. But we had a lot of fun. I was, like I said, I was looking forward to work with her after Domino, when they offered Gwenpool. She was on the list of the people you want to work with. And I was lucky enough to being offered a book with her. So, but it exceeded expectations, to be sure.
Okay, wait, now I have questions. Let's go back to that. So you getting an email from Jordan DeWitt and the project starting and coming together. How did you guys decide on this cast of characters? Was that
when was I
that, yeah, please.
No, when I got on board on board of the book. Actually, when I accepted the job, the gig, I was not told about the cast yet, and it took a few months of adjusting the cast, and must have been like, I don't really remember, it's a confusing period of time, that one, but it took a few months to adjust the whole thing. And I was not really privy to that part of the process. I was getting a few notes here and there, but once the cast was fully decided and set, that's when I jumped in and started with the whole design process and the whole thing.
Well, that it's funny because that was one of my questions, what was going to be about the design process. And I love, and I think I'm not alone in this, I love the outfits and the uniforms for X-Factor so much. And I would love to know, like, what was your inspiration for that? And how many other versions of the costumes did you go through before you settled on this? Just kind of how that process worked.
Actually, it was really fast because, as I said, it took us a little time to get the whole thing set up. So we didn't have that much time to do pre-production before actually start producing the book. So it had to be fast. It was more a process. There were not that many versions previous to the ones that have been seen on that book. Mostly because Leah had done a previous work of giving a fashion background to each one of the characters. She didn't per se design anything, but she gave me a whole lookbook for each one of the characters of the things they would wear when not in uniform. So it was more a work of distillation of what would that mean, or what would this person wear when they're designing a uniform for themselves in this context of not being exactly superheroes, but rather a nation-building government agency with a very specific mission. I don't know if I'm digressing a lot.
Yeah, that's incredible. That's so cool. And it comes through in the art, you know, like Rachel has this whole vibe. That's very cool.
Rachel did have a previous version in which she wore more of a trench coat closer to her Bacalo design. But as we were into that, one of our editors sent us a couple of pictures of a girl wearing a short jacket and those trousers and so on. And I really, really, really love Chris Bacalo, but I don't really like that particular design for Rachel. So I was happy to ditch the trench coat and go with this shorter version.
It's so interesting to hear you say that fashion played such an integral part of the design, because we've been calling it like the mutant fashion book since day one. There has been something so everybody sketching for Project Runway before mood about all of these books that has just been so powerful. And it's really put a personality on each person, like visually, like a visual personality.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you'd had like a strong relationship with any of these characters prior to X Factor. If like before working on them here, you were like, oh man, I love blank.
Not really. Apart from Rachel, no, to be quite honest. I met Rachel in Excalibur 1, drawn by Alan Davies, and I pretty much fell in love with her, you know, her pain and her good mood and all that I could read and I could perceive from her in that book. But that's pretty much it. I was not really an Alpha Flight reader or I mean, I have read comics with these guys before, but I didn't really have, you know, this basic connection to any of them apart from Rachel. And it was a nice, heartwarming process to get to know them, mostly through the fashion design process, getting to get on Leah's notes on them and going back and forth with her about what I thought of them, what she thought of them, what that meant as far as fashion goes, as far as body language goes too. So I've really fallen in love with them, mostly on this book.
And speaking of early Excalibur had quite a bit of mojo, and I know that was something that Arturo really like was so excited about.
Yeah, that I'm dying to know how that came about, because that was when we got, I guess, what was that, issue 2, and we were in the Mojo verse. It was such an unexpected surprise, because you guys had
right?
set this book.
It worked.
Oh, okay, it's going to be an investigation, and bam, we were in the Mojo verse. person. I was so happy and seeing Adam X and Shatterstar. Like, how did you guys decide on that? And how familiar with the Mojoverse were you before? Was that something you had read a lot through Excalibur, or do you have to do some homework?
Oh, I had to do a little homework because I read, you know, my Longshot and some Excalibur and so on back in the day, and I had to get back to it. Bless you, Marvel Unlimited. Again, I was not, I mean, I liked it, but I liked the whole scenery, but I had never, it had never been in my, you know, my wish list of place to go as an artist. And, but as I always say, wish lists are not as funny as surprises. So yeah, when I found out myself that we were going to Mojoverse and I had to, and we had kind of a task of redefining it a little for the 21st century, for the first half of the 21st century at the very least, That was exciting. And in a way, it was an advantage not to have this particularly dear relationship to the scenery. So I didn't feel anything was sacred.
Well, I think you guys did a really great job of updating it, because Mojoverse used to feel like just like cable television, but you guys definitely added this streaming social media kind of power to it. And it really worked. It really worked.
But yeah, now I have to know, what is on your wish list? You just said there is a wish list of things to work on, and now I gotta know.
What's in my wish list? Strangely enough, not that many mutants, to be honest. I would like at some point to be able to draw Spider-Man and Moon Knight. Ooh. For instance. But then again, it's been a few years on this job doing this, and yes, surprises have always been better, way, way better than the wish list.
David, speaking of your wish list, I know a lot of artists, when they first get on a project, have like a first artist request with the writer. Did you have a first artist request with Leah Williams when you first started X Factor?
No, not really. I sometimes, Gail, for instance, asked me a few times about what would I like to draw on Domino, and sometimes the writer asks, but I'd rather go with what they throw at me. I'd rather try and juggle with whatever point of view, not mine, because I know what I want to do with what I want to do. But the whole point of this thing, for me at least, or part of the excitement of working on these books, is precisely to work with stuff that I do not come up with, or that I do not know that I want yet, until they, you know, place it in front of me on a silver platter. So no, not really. As the book has advanced, and as our work process has advanced, there's more of a, you know, back and forth of stuff. But it's more like, you know, putting the toys on top of the table and just play around with them to give them the definitive shape before actually doing the book, or actually drawing the book, rather than saying, I would like to do this, or I would like to do that. I have had requests on a couple of, you know, minor details. I would like this thing that we're going to do in issue so-and-so. I would like this to be this. Would that be all right? Oh, yeah, sure. I will do that. It works. So there's a lot of sync between the both of us.
Is there anything exciting coming up that you can tease us about a little bit? Are we going back to Mojoverse? Are we getting some Jamie Madrox?
And remember, you can tell us all your secrets and we'll never repeat them on this podcast.
Okay. There are like a thousand things that you can be excited about that I cannot tell you about at all. And I won't.
Okay. Now I'm even more excited.
Well, then let me ask you an easy set of questions all about you. There's something I love to know about artists. I love to know what inspires you guys outside of comics. So if you've got a favorite TV show, movie, album, or book, just something that like really shapes your artistry, even if it's out of the realm of the funny mags.
Oh, I don't know. I'm a huge political junkie, both Spanish and US politics, European politics. I love The West Wing. I like reading almost anything that falls into my hands, although as of late I have not been able to read much, to be quite honest. But can I point that apart from The West Wing? I don't know, I could give you like a list of 10 books and the list would be different each day of the week. It pretty much depends on what high I'm on.
Well, you've got Arturo and I with West Wing, for sure.
That you said West Wing, I'm sitting here silently screaming joy because I've seen some of your West Wing tweets. And it's funny because Nico and I, early on in our friendship, I was in the midst of a West Wing rewatch. And and we would like exchange little, you know, quotes and stuff. And like, yes, it's like one of the best shows ever.
Absolutely.
I love that you watch it. That's so great. Yeah, it's been like, it was like an escapism during the Trump years, for sure.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
My dream is to be Ainsley Hayes. So everybody needs a dream, and that's mine. Now, I do have I want to steal a question from Arturo. Arturo, you wanted to know something about the Boneyard.
Yeah. The Boneyard is has such an iconic design already. Like it's one of those, you know, monuments on Krakoa that you see it and you're instantly, do you know where you're at? And I just wanted to know, like, what were some of your inspirations or references for that?
Mostly a particular architect that I really like, Taha Hadid, who does beautiful, beautiful buildings with marvelous, you know, lifelike structures, but they're huge, and the places she designs is they're amazing, and I draw quite a lot of inspiration from her.
Yeah,
every time I do not really know what to do with a room or whatever, I just go to my Pinterest board and take a look and see where that goes.
That's so cool. Yeah, we have one of her buildings here in Miami, and I had not really realized just how much it kind of does resemble the Boneyard. It looks like it has like vertebrae running through it. So yeah, that's really cool. That really comes through. And also, the Boneyard also kind of looks like DNA helix.
There's something about that, yeah.
Yeah, very cool.
Whenever I talk about this book, I would say the same. You might like it or not like it, but there's nothing in the book that's not well thought through and that has not like three or four or five ideas or concepts thrown in there just to make it solid. And there's a little bit of that. There's a little bit of a husky thing of a, not husk, rather kind of a pot feeling to the whole thing. And there's a lot of stuff in there. A lot of discussions about the general look of the building that we have talked about it being almost another member of the group, really, about being more than just a headquarters and so on. There's something there.
And I think the way that you guys so clearly isolate it in the visuals, it's such a component, whether it's that outside almost Titan's Tower sort of breakdown view we get, or it's the visual references that kind of conjure images of 70s, you know, Fisk Tower in the pages of Miller's Daredevil, that imposing figure on the page, that I really think so much about X-Factor is shape. And, you know, when I think about Dokken in the pages of X-Factor, Dokken is like big daddy man, and he's so hot. He's almost... It's almost like a deforming of his size because he's so big now. And when I think about previous iterations, he's very slender at times and very almost like lanky. And I personally prefer this new design on him. And I was wondering how much freedom you guys were given in terms of that overall like aesthetic change on the character.
Really a lot. And we were given a lot of freedom, and we gave ourselves a lot of freedom. When the time came to reinterpret these characters into X-Factor, how do I put this? Hold on. Okay, this is just me, right? Okay, this is just me going around into my own head, to dig stuff up to get to know what to do with this. Meaning I'm not speaking for the whole team. One of the themes and one of the things I like best about the book is that it is mostly about rebirth, it's about resurrection, it's about reinvention, it's about rehabilitation. So these guys, they have finally, after many years, after a long story of pain and so on, they've come to a place in which they can become themselves in a way, reinvent themselves. And I wanted to show that in how they look. I gave myself an excuse to give them whatever look I wanted to give to them, because they are in many ways reinventing themselves and forgiving themselves for a lot of things and growing into themselves. In the case of Dokken, that's literal. He has grown. He has grown stronger and bigger and hotter. And in many ways, in my head at the very least, that's because he's in a place which is Krakow, and he's in a team which is X Factor that allows him to do that. The seismic nature of the change that Krakow is, I think it has to be reflected into the looks and the attitudes and the body language and the fashion and the all the ways of expression that these characters have. So we were given a lot of liberty to change them, so to say, or to make them evolve, but we gave ourselves that liberty to let them, you know, expand, so to say.
Speaking of expansion, is there any chance that Lorna Dane is going to go back to her big, beautiful perm one day? Because that is one thing I miss, is Lorna's huge, beautiful hair from the your David run.
I don't know. Who knows? Who knows? I know I wouldn't tell you.
Putting out a request for Lorna's perm.
Okay, let me write that down.
Here's a question about Lorna, actually, that I find something about her that has been striking from the first teasers of X Factor is you've given her this like little crown of energy.
The crown.
Yes. Yeah. Could you speak about that a little bit? Because that was something very new, and it's distinctive. It's definitely part of look.
That was actually a request from Leah. She wanted a crown around her head, and I kind of link it to her masky thing. The word escapes me now. She has always worn the diadem. Mm-hmm. I like it. As far as I'm concerned, that's part of the suit. That's not so much a manifestation of her powers, but something that the bone jar has given her within the equipment of her suit that she can use as a conduit and weapons and so on.
Well, that's really nice. I was gonna ask. Cool. Speaking of like Lorna and the way you're drawing people, I love the way you draw facial expressions on all the characters beyond X Factor, but especially X Factor. And given how a lot of artists use references and everything, I was wondering, when you draw the facial expressions so well, do you use a reference for anything?
Not usually, no. Every now and then I take a picture of myself making a face, but I don't know, that must be once every two issues of the issues, because I don't get to nail exactly the expression I want for one particular panel or whatever, but it's mostly, you know, sketching and moving around the features and trying to get exactly where I want them to go.
David, do you have a favorite character that you just love to draw?
You mean in the book?
Yeah, or even more broadly, just any character that to draw.
This is going to sound a little, you know, corny, but the one I'm drawing at the moment.
Nice.
It's always the one I'm drawing at the moment. They have to, you know, get me somehow. I have to fall for them for some reason, whatever reason. I don't really have favorites. And in the context of the book specifically, I really can't have a favorite, because I've honestly come to love them all very much. They're my kids.
No.
No, they really are. I'm very protective.
And speaking of kids, one of the things that this book gave me that I loved the most is New Mutants Volume 2 and the New X-Men Academy X Era. Those kids like meant the world to me. They were the thing I came into comics reading. So when they all sort of got sidelined and disappeared for years, it was a little heartbreaking. Prodigy getting a spotlight has been so great, but getting that New Mutants Volume 2, New X-Men Academy X reunion in the pages of X-Factor was so incredible. But the more I think about it, you had like 20 characters to draw that issue. You had the five, you had X-Factor.
Oh, yeah.
New X-Men. How, like, I can't even imagine your sketchbook at this point for these characters and your reference guide. When you have to capture 20 essences with, you know, my co-host said, these dramatically powerful faces and these expressions that say so much, like, how much effort does it go into to create Sophia for the first time and create Elixir for the first time and Icarus?
I don't really know, to be quite honest. I wouldn't be able, I mean, I could speak for hours about the, you know, the physical process of drawing stuff and the whole process of setting the page and so on. But as far as characters go, I don't really know. What I can tell you is these are people. These are persons that react and feel and suffer like anybody else. And if you're going through pain, if you're going through any kind of tribulation, or you're excited, or you're surprised, or whatever, you just start. No matter, doesn't really matter if you can fly or throw flames through your ears or whatever. at the end of the day, they're people, they're persons, they're not humans, but humans. I mean, not humans because they're mutants, but also the way Leah writes these people, anyone really, it really helps. She writes with a warmth and an intelligence. I mean, I knew she was a smart writer, but she's just amazingly intelligent and empathic and warm, and you can't really help to emote when you read these guys, and it has to come through when you draw them.
I love that information about Leah Williams because I love her so much, and I've been wanting her to get on a main book like this for a while.
She's sharp, man. She's I never ever approach anyone in conventions, in whatever. I never approach anyone, fellow writers, fellow artists, fellow pros. Like 1 year before I got there with her for Gwenpool, I approached her in New York Comic Con's Marvel party because I loved what she wrote and what she did. And I had to go there and introduce myself like a fanboy. And it's like the second time I've ever done that.
I just keep imagining her sending you like the lookbook for all of the characters. I just love like that granularity. There's so much thought and consideration and just building all of this invisible stuff into the character.
Absolutely.
David, it's probably a weird question to ask, but since we brought up Leah Williams, I'm going to ask it anyway. My favorite Leah Williams work so far, besides X-Factor, has been amazing, was her basically What If issue of Magic, where she wrote her Sorcerer Supreme. Second to that is like the Emma issue X-Men Black. So since you're such a Leah fan, and I know this interview is about you, but it's about your interests as well, what would be your favorite Leah Williams work besides X-Factor, obviously?
Gwenpool Strikes Back.
Yeah, that makes sense. I did love that work. That was a really great, amazing story.
That was really fun, and I was really surprised to be offered that book. And I was about to reject the offer until they told me it was Leah writing. Because I didn't really see myself drawing Gwenpool, honestly. But there you go. They told me it was Leah, and I said, oh, hell yeah, let's do that.
Well, now that Gwenpool is on Krakoa sometimes, do we have, are there any, and you might not be able to answer this, are there any plan to see her appear in the pages of X-Factor?
I wouldn't tell you if they were.
Very understandable.
David, I want to thank you so much for coming out and making the time for us and being a part of this interview. Your work has been so significant to us as a team experiencing this new age of X-Men. There's a deftness to the emotional vocabulary of the work in X-Factor. It has the ability to kind of push through boundaries. I know that I've been the victim of some amount of emotional abuse, and seeing so much of it translated in the pages of X-Factor has been really healing and really powerful. And I just know I want to thank you guys for making a book, like you've said, really about people. These don't read like superhero characters. They read like people at a time where we really need people. And I just want to thank you so much. Rod, Arturo, did you guys have anything else you wanted to say or ask?
I just want to say, David, I really love your work, and I can't wait to see more of it. Your art is very spectacular, and I just want you to know that you already know this, but your work inspires me to read more and just enjoy the art even more.
And I just want to say thank you for making Dawkins so hot.
So hot.
So hot.
My pleasure. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. Thank you for the questions. It's humbling to hear these kind of things because, to be quite honest, this whole drawing comics and in general and our book in particular is basically a very selfish enterprise for me because I do it because I love it. I mean, I just enjoy the drawing them and the doing them so much. But knowing that, and in all honesty, when they're up there, they can mean so much to people I don't even know. It's humbling and it's touching and thank you very much, guys, for letting me know.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, thank you so much.
Hey everybody, Nico here again, and this next segment kind of picks up on some threads that Josh and I started a couple of months back in Nico and Josh Shout About Apocalypse. We're joined by Kyle, and the three of us talk about Cable Number 7, which was a transformative issue for young Cable. Whether it was a strong analysis of his relationship with his sister, or the threat of his clone's return, this issue laid out the aspects of Cable's life, ultimately culminating in a possible team-up with Domino, and the three of us could not stop talking about the ways in which young Cable completely transforms the idea of who Cable was, yet follows through on so many of the ideas the original character put out there. We hope you guys enjoy this segment.
I enjoyed reading it with my son and watching my son just fucking love the Joshua Cassara art on all of the goddamn sea monsters. Like, I think I have more feels from that issue, but it wasn't really the issue as much as it was like the combo of, you know, like my son getting to really appreciate it, enjoy it, be bowled over by that Cassara art.
Oh man, what? That eyeball panel. Oh,
we had to turn back and go back to the eyeball like three times. Yes.
It's why I went fucking apeshit over Cassara's post of the pencils, because I was like, this is too good. And when I think about where X-Force started and I think about where it's at now, I'm like, it's not that you were ever not good, but it's going to be wild looking at this page and the first pages of this book in an omnibus and think to yourself, this is one guy in a year.
Wow.
The main thing that you would get excited about in X-Force was that it was the first one kind of digging into like how the government is going to operate, like the Krakoan government, and giving us kind of deeper Krakoan lore. And now it's the Cassara art book. Like that's
1000%. And I think he sort of laid that gauntlet down in Ten of Swords. It's not the Ten
Definitely.
Of Swords, the Wolverine and X-Force two-parters were every week. But I feel like because it was one issue of story stretched out over two issues, the art told so much of it. And that, what was it? The
Battle of Blightspoke is the dividing line. From the Battle of Blightspoke forward, that has been Cassara's book, and Percy gets to write it.
And it's not that Percy's carrying that banner in a lot of ways for Marvel, whether it was Wolverine, the audiobook, you know, being someone who takes a character like Wolverine, who's a visual, visceral, bloody motherfucker of a character, and finding a way to make him an audio character in an organic way is kind of carrying the banner for the company. Like,
we need to have a whole backup story episode where we talk about that, because I just finished that and I have a lot of thoughts that for once are not the same as your thoughts.
I didn't realize that that was Percy.
Yeah, and it's like Maddie's favorite thing in the world, the Wolverine audio drama. I really do think that is what got him to be willing to do this show. How much he enjoyed re-entering these characters organically through that lens.
It was great.
So, you know, we basically started talking. I mean, that makes this is X. I'm Nico, and you guys can find me at NicoAction on Twitter and Instagram, NicoAction.
I'm Josh. You can find me at Asleep at the Wheel, WEIL on Twitter, and at asleepatthewheel.com. And now and for the next 2 years, as I am officially a Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate in the state of Florida, you can also find me at Wheel, the number 4 U.S. Senate on Twitter, and Wheel4USSenate.org.
And I'm Kyle, and you can find me on both Twitter and Instagram at Drantis82. That's DRANTIS82.
We're here to talk today about the solo issue that I think I am happiest with since the Dawn of X began. This is probably my favorite single solo character issue. We're talking about Cable Number 7 by Jerry Duggan and Phil Noto. And for all purposes that matter, this was Cable reacting to the world around him in a way I feel like had been sorely missing from the pages of Cable for the last year, unfortunately. Now, before we even get into this issue, I want to take a step back and talk Cable for a moment. Now, Josh, you and I very loudly made our thoughts on Cable known.
We have talked about Cable and his family and his peoples and a number of the characters in this issue before at length. Yes. Yeah.
And I have some very passionate opinions thereon.
But I don't know what you're talking about.
That leads me to ask. I don't know what you're talking about at all. There was no point at which I had to adjust the audio. So there was no clipping. So, Kyle, my question for you, Cable history, Cable present. I know that we've talked about how like Cable took over the New Mutants at the point at which you couldn't get to a New Mutants because there was too much missing in between. And then you didn't really read X-Force. So Cable was like, you know, you couldn't tell him apart from his twin brother Satellite. So what I want to know then is how you feel about Cable now and where you sit in terms of this bigger chronology of a character whose definition is his anachronology.
So it's interesting because when I started reading, he wasn't really present in the books that I was picking up. So I really wasn't aware of him until X-Men Deconstructed, was that it? Where they were sending back the original five and young Cable killed old Cable and...
I believe that was X-Men Extermination.
That's it. Thank you.
Which, it's kind of ridiculous, just a side note, that was the second event called Extermination in a short period of time that dealt with time travel and alternate universes being, like, stacked together in a weird way. So it's sort of having left at the point where there was the previous Extermination running between Extreme X-Men and Age of Apocalypse and coming back in at an Extermination where the original five were facing down a kid Cable. I was like, did you learn nothing from when I quit?
Oh, and so, if you read the in-between issues from that period, the answer is no, they did not learn. They learned nothing, nothing at all.
Oh, so yeah, kid Cable is the only Cable that I have experience with. And even then, when he first came on the scene, I wasn't really comfortable with him because I knew about old Cable's history, kind of. It was weird seeing him getting killed off by himself. But I've really come to love him in the years since.
And, you know, I got to admit, I don't know if it's just that, like, he's the kind of student that as a teacher, I would find myself being like, come on, kid, you're so bright and you're so good at what you do. If you don't do the fucking homework, I can't help you. Like, you got to show up for, like, that Cable's that kid. Like, I really want to, like, protect this version of Cable. Whereas, like, you know, Daddy Cable, all I ever wanted to do was get him in a sling and make him call me Daddy. Like, you know, but this Cable, I want to, like, take care of him and, like, help him be okay. Josh, I know a lot of what you think about adult Cable. Well, I guess no. I know what you think about a different kid Cable. But, Josh, where do you stand on this kid Cable?
We've talked about this in previous episodes a couple times. This kid Cable, for me at first, I was excited when I first saw him in Extermination because I love the old Ascani Sun and Adventures of Cyclops and Phoenix and that Cable, like the young Cable growing up in that dystopian future, getting to be raised by his parents, even if he doesn't really like all of that, saved by his sister and just fighting Apocalypse and the brother's strife and all of that. I love all of that. And so when we saw that, oh, and clearly the visual design was based on the Ascani Sun miniseries. Okay, so we're getting this character. And then he turned out to be nothing like that character. And it kind of threw me off at first, but I accepted it as we came into the Hickman era because, okay, you know what? We're going to kind of backtrack him and rewind him back so he's a little less mature. But that's so that way we can have him maturing and growing up in this awesome Summers family that we've never had an opportunity to actually build and let them have before. So I was okay with it because we were getting something that I think was better than if they had just used the character before. Since Duggan has taken over him, I think that he's really been a great teen character. Like, I think that this is probably the book that veers youngest in their line. Like, this is the book that I would put in a teenager's hands because as a high school teacher, Kid Cable reminds me so much of real teenage boys. Like, he is an authentic teenage boy making all of the stupid bad decisions that teenage boys make in all the same ways.
I can't help it. I just, like, the teacher in me, I gotta protect this kid. It's driving me nuts.
I think it's great for that. Much like Officer DeStefano said in this issue, you know, I've met your father and I've met your sister. You are by far the worst. You know, like, I love your family and, okay, you're the worst member of the family. I love the interactions with his family. I love the Phil Noto art. Like, this book keeps me, I accept that I'm not its audience. You know, that I'm someone that gets too, you know, my patience is run thin from teenage boys throughout the week enough that I'm not really looking to deal with more kind of teenage boy nuance, my downtime. But I still do appreciate and like this book. And I think Duggan's really shown himself as being one of the top writers right now to be able to give authentic voices to people that are not himself, which is not easy because we have a ton of middle-aged white men comic book writers who only know how to make comic book characters sound like middle-aged white men. And so it is a joy and a treat that we are getting dug in on a couple of these X books dealing with non-middle-aged white male characters.
What's fascinating is he actually still kills it on the middle-aged white men characters. If you check out our coverage of Savage Avengers, you can hear a really fascinating interpretation of how he treats Doom, Strange, and Voodoo as three very different doctors, but manages to give them, I mean, not that Voodoo is white by any means, but there is a lot of deft attention given to the older men that he writes as well. He has such strength with women over in the pages of Marauders. And, you know, more to Josh's point, if you want to hear us talk a little bit about a time where perhaps a middle-aged white man continued to define racism by the standards of a middle-aged white man, check out our new YouTube channel over at X's for Podcast on YouTube, where you can find an amazing two-hour deep dive into God Loves, Man Kills, split over several parts. And you probably don't want to miss that. I think it was a lot of fun to make, and I hope you guys enjoyed it as much as we had fun making it. It is so much to what Josh is saying that my initial reaction that I just want to protect this kid kind of comes through. There's a weird level of protection I want to offer him, though, and that's protection from his own past. There were several things I was perhaps hoping that a Kid Cable reboot would give us either freedom from or new access to. I was a little worried that if they gave Kid Cable the giant guns, it would not be good. Especially in this era of we need to get the fuck rid of the Punisher. And, you know, call him, you know, Anti-Castle or Frankly Killer. But, like, you know, he needs to stop being associated with law enforcement and the macabre. So we need to, you know, get away from that idea. One of the things that has really worked is the sci-fi design of all of Cable's guns. It's this very super cool laser blaster kind of feel. It's a little bit more,
they've leaned into the fantasy edge as opposed to the grim and gritty, which plays to Nodo's strengths and helps avoid those kind of comparisons to actual teenage boys with big guns. Makes him not Kyle Rittenhouse.
So what it makes me then think is, okay, I'd had some fears about elements of Cable translating to the present in a way that kind of made me grimace. This issue went out of their way to chop all of those concerns down. I mean, the one fucking thing I didn't get in this issue that you could have done to alleviate that last fear I had was you could have had the Wild Pack show up. That's like the one other thing you could have done. And frankly, the end of this issue leaves room for that. Now, this issue sees Cable moving forward with his life in the wake of Ten of Swords. He continues to investigate the missing mutant children arc that was introduced in the first four issues of Cable by Jerry Duggan. And it sees a lot of his interpersonal relationships defined, redefined, or examined. We see a number of incredible interactions. And I guess there'd really be nowhere better to start than the first interaction, which is in many ways with a ghost. Now,
can we back up for a second? Because I had
that. I love that you want to go before the first issue. Yes, I like that you want to go before the beginning.
Okay, so in my notes, I started with the opening words of this issue, like the first thing to like address, because I thought it was really good and poignant, and I loved it. And then I realized that I needed to back up before that because remembering when I first sat down to read this, I had some apprehension and nervousness because I am not reading King in Black and am not a fan of that stuff going on that side of the Marvel Universe and was not the most excited person when I hit the last page of Sword number 2. So the fact that when I opened this and found out that Jerry Duggan is pretending that King in Black isn't happening, much like I am, made me very happy. And so I felt like that was something that also needed to be addressed in this, that like, because last week we finished with a very different Cable than we started with this week.
There's such a methodical understanding to the release points. Sometimes it seems like stuff is out of sequence, but it's so the end point lines up at the, like they know what they're doing to the point where, you know, sometimes books have to be moved around here and there. I'm not sure he's pretending it's not happening so much as the chronology on it hasn't all come into focus yet, but I can't imagine that Al Ewing, the superstar he is going to have his book more or less sidelined by the solo title that it services, or that services it, moreover. So I don't know. I think we may yet still see this Cable react to King in Black once King in Black is over.
Okay, so that helps make my feelings about being confused about where this book lands a little better. I was confused because it just felt like this should have come out a couple weeks ago.
I agree.
This is taking place almost immediately after they get back from Otherworld.
Yeah.
And they haven't resurrected Gorgon yet. They haven't.
No, and I do get that this probably takes place before Sword One. But it was at least for, you know, the moment a reprieve, and in my head canon, I can still pretend King in Black isn't happening.
Well, and then here's a question for you guys before we go a step further, because that brings me to a question that I've really been wondering. I love him. I am a huge Cable fan. I have a custom teddy bear that I have redesigned into Cubble, and he has a metal arm so that my Jean Grey Build-A-Bear has her son. Like, it's love so Cable.
Cute. It is right? So cute.
Kyle has met Cubble. So, like, I love this character, but he only ever had two books because it made sense. He was super popular at the time. He led X-Force, and there was still so much canon to mine. And here, do we need Cable on Sword and in a solo book? Do you need Cable to have that duality, or is there just not that much Kid Cable to go around?
I like the idea for where he's at in his life. I like the idea that we get a Cable centered around his family, where he's going to feel younger, right? Like, so any of us who have ever been a 17-year-old boy know that you're at a point in your life where you're going out and you feel like an adult. You feel like you are capable of doing things and you're responsible enough and you have enough freedom and power to do things. But then when you're around your dad, you're like a kid again because dad's there. And I like that we get both sides of him. I think that there is, for a character of that age who's being drawn, not depicted so well at that age in one book, to let him kind of flesh out and flex and show what he can do away from his family in the other one is good. It services the character and services the world nicely. I don't have a problem with that.
I enjoy seeing Cable in all of these books. My concern is more the logistics of Cable running around on his own while also being in charge of security on the Peak, while also spending time with his family and possibly joining their new X-Men team. It seems a lot for a 17-year-old kid.
and finding time to shag a cuckoo in the bushes twice a day.
That too.
So Mike Carey, when he started writing Lucifer, he gave an interview in the pages of Vertigo Preview, the column or On the Ledge, whatever the fuck the column was that year. And he was asked why he's writing Lucifer. And he said, because it's an autobiography. I am the complete opposite of everything Lucifer Morningstar does. Every decision he makes is the complete opposite of what I would do. That is not to say that I am an angel, but that is to say that every page of this man breathes the antithesis of who I am. So in that regard, because this is everything I am not, this is an autobiography. And you can't get that out of your fucking head when you read it. You know what I mean? It changes the work. And I can't help but wonder, knowing our backgrounds, all three of us, I wonder if the reason that Kyle's like, that seems like a lot of stress on Cable, whereas Josh and I are a little bit more like, yeah, but it's more about the fact that, like, he's two people, he's got adult Cable, you know, the private and personal masks, right? I think, and that's because Kyle played a little bit more by the rules growing up and kind of still does now. Kyle, you are a very I want to do what's right kind of person, whereas Josh and I are a little bit more like, oh no, I see myself in this guy. I was the cocky son of a bitch that was constantly getting in trouble.
Josh and Nico are both lucky to have survived past 20.
I am lucky to have survived past 17. So I think that there's something to that Jerry Duggan has created such an incredibly vibrant, powerful character that we have that kind of reaction as people who were similar in ways. And I think that's such an incredible statement on who he is. And I just really love that about it, because I kind of fall somewhere between the Josh camp and the posing of the question itself. I don't think that the character has the marketability at the moment. And my concern, more than anything, isn't with, are the X-Men ever going to go away as a line? The X-Men are never going to get Fantastic Four, right? That's not going to happen. The least X books you're ever going to see published at a time is what just happened with House of X, Powers of Ten. You're never going to have one book of X-Men a week forever. And you're certainly never going to have no books for more than 1 week unless it's some kind of magical reset event. For that reason, my thought is about how they're programming the future to think about the books now. Something I've repeatedly said is that if you take a look at the animated shows, you can see the cyclical programming of setting up the expectation of that character to later appear in the live action versions about 5 years before Luke Cage and Iron Fist started appearing in Defender related product shows. They started to appear on Ultimate Spider-Man as Peter's classmates, so you'd have a sense of who they are. Marvel does this consistently. About 5 years before they're going to make a character a big live action deal, they introduce them to the younger market to program that younger market to have a relationship with that character so that when they have spending income, or at least the ability to command spending income, they spend it on that thing and have that association with that character. So my concern is possibly that the market cannot sustain Kid Cable unless there is going to be some sort of push to make Kid Cable some kind of Dennis the Menace-esque mutant icon. I concern that he's going to burn out his page time.
Well, the feeling I get from Sword, too, is that, you know, Sword has a bunch of characters that are very integral for making it work. And the two most famous characters in that book are the least integral in Cable and Magneto. I feel like Al Ewing is setting it up where, you know, we're getting some recognizable characters who can play roles, but that ultimately that book is going to cycle through and have different characters filling those roles. We're going to get different configurations of the six that we need to make it happen and different people overseeing, to the point where, you know, probably at some point in the book, Frenzy and Fabian Cortez might be the two most well-known characters we see there, you know, but you just can't launch it and do the first arc that way.
Maybe they're going to trade Storm and Cable between Marauders and Sword.
Oh.
Right? We know that Storm is heading toward whatever the hell they found in Sword number one. That wouldn't be a bad decision, right? Make Cable a little bit more terrestrial so there's a little bit more... Oh, I guess, you know, when everybody can teleport these days, I guess it's not a big deal to teleport. But to the point, this
now
issue...
Now on to page one. Now on to page one.
Exactly. This issue is Cable number seven. So the first thing we see is the reaction to Gorgon. And, like, this was everything to me because Gorgon evening the score. I am such a fucking Hickman fanboy from Secret Warriors. So Gorgon is a character. And, you know, between that and my Wolverine, I keep getting called a Wolverine stan. Every room I'm in, someone's always like, oh, Wolverine stan over here. And I'm like, the shit. I've just, like, started editing it out. Right? It's true, though. And so, like, I have an affection for Gorgon. And then my boy Gorgon pulls it out in Ten of Swords. And the fact that we know he's resurrected in the pages of X-Factor. Cool, cool. The fact that he's getting some attention here, where his sacrifice is shown as valued. Gorgon's demise proves that there really is redemption for anyone on Krakoa. That's what this page told me, that it doesn't matter that Gorgon was at one point a supervillain. All mutants were offered a home on Krakoa, and that Gorgon died doing what he swore he would do. He pledged himself to Krakoa, and he died doing that. Like, that was a really great touch to put in a book about a soldier, even if that character is not currently acting as a soldier.
Yes, and, you know, there's deeper resonance here, too. You know, Duggan does a good job of showing us kind of the stuff that Cable's burying. And, you know, it doesn't work without Noto's art and given, you know, those kind of that facial expressions, you know, where we see a couple issues of Cable's face where, you know, he's got stuff underneath and he's not trying to show what he's feeling, but, you know, we can kind of see enough of it. Like, he has a lot of guilt. He hated the way X of Swords went down. He knows exactly where he fucked up. And it comes up a couple times in this issue. It comes up early on with, you know, that Gorgon had to clean up his mess. Like, if Gorgon came one shy of that massive body count he put up, like, they don't get there. And, you know, because Cable lost when he should have won. You know, he gave up the shot, you know, and it happened again with the chandelier. Like, it was on his mind when they were storming that house. You know, it's following him now that he could have been better, that he screwed up. Like, it's weighing on him. Yeah, like what that means in terms of how he sees these other characters, the other characters that were part of X of Swords who didn't screw up, who earned their points. You know, the look at Krakoa, the Krakoans who, you know, think of him as a hero because everyone who fought in that tournament and came back is a hero, but he doesn't see himself that way. Like, it just increases his shame. And, you know, it cranks up and it hits that note very subtly a couple times throughout the issue in a way that really works to kind of deepen this character and build off of him post X of Swords.
It definitely comes off as him suffering from very strong imposter syndrome, that he doesn't belong in these situations because of the way that he failed at pretty much everything during Ten of Swords.
If you're reading digital, it's page 5. I'm not sure what page it is in the physical, but there's that amazing shot of the back of Cable with his sword on the ground, and it's on the page with the, I'm going to call it, brilliantly reused Rachel silhouette, and I'm going to talk all about that in a moment. But there's this look of Cable on the bottom panel, that perfect widescreen panel at the bottom. And, you know, speaking of imposter syndrome, I feel like in many ways Cable has become Cloud Strife.
Yes.
He knows that he is this other person, and he has this other person's memories imprinted on him, and he is representative of this amazing thing to these many people, but he really is this...
And they gave him the Final Fantasy VII sword.
Exactly! They gave him the Buster Blader, and that actually completely connects to my point from earlier. You introduce this idea into the cultural vernacular so that several years later it has impact on the future. Suddenly, you can see elements of this video game from 1997 all over this comic, and it's this idea of even if you've got a gun, you can still have a giant sword, and that's still pretty cool. And that's like what Cable and Strife both represent. Final Fantasy is a world where several people have machine gun body parts, but people are still like, give me a moment to cast this fire spell, and it's just fine, you know? And I do need to touch on the brilliantly reused Rachels. I actually said to myself at the start of this issue, this can't possibly be Phil Noto. Like, he's doing like 3 books a month right now, right? And like, I literally had a moment where I was like, you can't convince me this is Phil Noto doing a 3rd book this month or 2nd book, whatever it is. But, you know, there
until is you get to the blam, 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 full page splash that he just blew me away with, that he totally owned and no one else could have owned that way. And you're like, yeah, it's Phil Noto.
Oh, yeah. But I mean, even beyond that, if you take a look at that same page, page 5, you can actually see that it's the same Rachel used multiple times, angled slightly differently. And that's not a laziness factor. That's an artistry tool. Mm-hmm. No, you can see that he uses the same build of Rachel, creating this visual consistency. And in a lot of ways, that depth of consistency creates the idea that it's a movie scene or a television scene. It's exactly framed a certain way. She's in that outfit. It was filmed that one time. Hopefully there's no pickup shots where it turns from a pancake to a waffle to a muffin back to a pancake. So this sibling, I don't even know how to describe my love of this sibling dynamic. And, you know, this came up when we did it in...
Yeah.
The Adventures of Cyclops and Phoenix.
We talked about, we love them so much. We love them so much.
So like their friendship as siblings, because like nobody can get it but the two of them. Like to refer to these characters as anachronisms, right? Like, you know, sometimes characters are like, but you know, in this reality, my parents weren't even born. Okay. They're just the wrong versions of these people. Like there's no other way to put it. Y'all just wrong.
And you guys, you know, since we're all in the same group chat, you know that like when I find random issues, I think a couple months ago I came home with like, I found a random issue of like Cable something from like 1997, you know, in a bargain, you know, in the front of the dollar bin at my shop when I was picking up my books. Like 5 minutes later, I tweeted it. I'm like, oh my God, it has Rachel in it. It's a Cable and Rachel show. Like, yes, like I still get excited like of any period like Cable and Rachel stuff, but. You know, the way Noto uses her here, too, it's great because it's not what Lee is doing in X Factor.
Oh, 1,000,000%.
We get those two sides again. Like, Leah is writing her as, you know, like she's stoner Rachel that like, and that's her at home. Like, that's her in her dorm room. But then when she comes home and she has her little brother who she has to take care of because she has taken care of him in ways that like go, that transcend space and time. Like, she has to take care of him. That like, no, she's big girl pants and following him around, and she's the more mature, older sister Rachel. it's one of the, it makes this whole line so rewarding that we're getting different takes on the characters in different books, but that they don't contradict each other. They complement each other and make the characters more whole and human.
Yeah, yeah. It's like you take on a different persona as you need to in order to deal with different situations, but it's still part of yourself.
Growing up, my sister took care of me and was my protector and was always the one who was like, don't do that thing. And I see myself and my sister in every panel of Rachel and Cable. And I don't know if that's me projecting, like, oh, that's so my experience. But like, I really can see that older sister, come on, like her being like, oh my God, you've had your license 2 weeks. How do you already have a parking ticket? How much money do you need to borrow? Right? Like I can see that dynamic for them and it's so tangible. There's it's the body language. It's the level of linguistic matching. The way they talk together is really beautiful. My sister and I had a secret language all the time. Like we would like signal to each other or not say any words and just give each other eyes to communicate things. It's amazing to see Rachel and Cable have that kind of private communication. Now here it's aided by the, you know, the magic of telepathy. But Cable and Rachel are really given depth of like siblinghood here. This really cashes in on the promise of X-Men number two. X-Men number two said this was going to be a great era for Summers' sibling dynamic, and I really feel like it pays off here.
Absolutely, it does. And, you know, we see it a couple times throughout. You know, they have that brother and sister way of, you know, where he's teasing her or trying to be like, you're not as strong, like I'm stronger than you think I am. But, you know, it really means like, thank you, I love you. And just the way she has his back, you know, there was a couple of the really great scenes in this book revolved around them. And the one that stands out the most is, you know, when the babies are being held hostage and he's got his guns pointed at him. The pages leading up to my aforementioned blam, 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 full page splash where, you know, she's floating outside in the background and, you know, she knows what he's thinking because, you know, they have the little telepathy bond. He shoots all the bad guys and she catches the babies.
And that really is the nature of their relationship. When she was introduced to protect Kate, to protect the timeline, and then came back to our time to make sure the future didn't happen. In that regard, she came back to protect us and then became the mother Ascani. Cable came back to raise an army. Cable came back to be a soldier and train an army of soldiers. That really is the nature of their dynamic, and it's explored beautifully here in subtle ways. She's very comfortable being the clever assist, and he's more than excited to be the muscle. Especially in the face of the Order of X. You know, especially because Cable is a guy who grew up around the word false prophet a lot. He's a guy who grew up around whether or not your genetic code mattered. And while he might not be old man Cable, he still has parts of that in who he is. So the idea, like Rachel says, that people liking mutants is like kind of new for her. She needs a minute here, right? There's a lot of this Order of X kind of false mutant language, and I was wondering what you guys think that means for the line as a whole. This idea of, like, mutant purity is used to celebrate Krakoa in some ways, but I think here we can see that it offers a detrimental reality as well.
So let's stop for a minute and let's switch over into an alternate universe where Children of the Atom was actually released instead of just used to tease us for years on end like it was a New Mutants trailer. How would, yes, the idea of this cult, this mutant worshiping cult, would we already have more thoughts on that? Like, mutants are a thing. A lot of this goes back to Morrison and the mutant culture idea and what Morrison did with New X-Men, creating mutant culture, having, you know, mutant bands and mutant fashion and, you know, making mutants cool and chic, having, you know, mutant organizations on campuses. That has kind of come and gone, but Hickman grabbed a hold of that and is really hitting it hard again. Like, mutants are a cool thing, and people who aren't mutants, especially now that, you know, you're not seeing them at their weakest, you're not seeing them fractured and divided and persecuted, they're not to be pitied. They're standing up for themselves. They are creating a better world, and they are sharing that better world and making it available to humans and others as well in the form of their medicines and, you know, what they're giving out to the nations that recognize their sovereignty. Mutants are a big deal, and there's going to be people who see them that way. Not just, you know, college kids who want to be like them or wish they could shoot lasers from their face. There's going to be, you know, weird Christian culty people too, or whatever, I guess. But it's definitely a different world for mutants now. And, you know, the fact that they're not just feared or pitied is a big deal again.
And I think it kind of translates into a societal cultural element. When minorities are depicted in their emergence, they're depicted as usually some sort of salacious reality, like, that's taboo. And then it quickly becomes, no, that's taboo. You don't talk about it. So then the struggle for minority recognition is this slow, I have to come out process. And it's, I think, part of why gay culture had such a hard time accepting its own racism for so long, because they were the minority. They weren't ready to share the minority spotlight. It took so long for gays to be recognized. And it's something that X-Men resisted for so long. This idea that, okay, we're no longer this super minority where we're in fear for our lives every second. There's good times now. We're still in fear. You know, it's still not a great world. There's still people coming after us. But this, in many ways, is a retranslation of that we are the minority idea. And I think X-Men was really due for an update on how they handled the idea of being different. Kyle, I know for you, you came out later. So you entered gay culture at a different point in your life, right? And right. So much of this is targeted at the coming out experience for the teenager and, you know, Cable included. How do you feel about the update to the idea of the minority identity, especially as someone who came into your minority identity at a later point in the struggle?
It's a little difficult, I think, for me to kind of connect in that way, mostly because I still struggle with acceptance of myself, and I kind of understand how Rachel feels about it, where she's still getting used to people being fans of mutants. So yeah, I can kind of relate, but at the same time, it's weird.
And I mean, I think you're having an honest difficulty framing your reaction because it's such a complex thing for you to react to personally. Whereas I'm like the publicity guy and I'm like, people like mutants right now, get on TV, make them like us more, make them want to party. And like, I have such this natural, it's changed. Oh, it's different now. Okay, we run with it, right? And that's such a humongous part of my reaction. And that's why I longed for Morrison's mutant culture to return. So Josh, I'm so glad you brought that up, because I've actually felt so frequently like we were always on the verge of Marvel saying that now we've entered the Days of Future Past. Like, I'm always nervous that they're about to say Days of Future Past is about to come true now. But instead, what they've said is the promise of Morrison's new X-Men becoming a line instead of a single book has finally come true. And it's been refined for a modern generation, sure. But this Order of X has to be, at least some in some ways, a response to the U-Men of new X-Men. This idea of false mutants gaining mutanthood. There's a really powerful parallel to how that approach to mutancy has changed. Instead of harvesting them to make yourself better, these guys just want to worship them. Of course.
But. Then we get the really cool psychic imprint page with that beautiful pink image of who's behind it.
And see, that was literally about to be my words I was about to say. But of course, we later find out that someone's behind it.
I know, I was waiting for the point when I could jump in.
Oh, I love that. Oh, that's fucking hot. So yeah, do you want to introduce everybody's favorite pink Vision Daddy?
Yes. Okay. So this was probably the thing that I got most excited about in this issue. And there were a lot of things I loved. I loved that Noto splash page. I love the Cable Rachel. But I have been waiting for Strife to appear. I have thoughts. I have I'm conflicted. I don't know. I want both of them. Maybe I want both of them at the same time. Do I want Old Man Strife or do I want Kid Strife? And if you've read Adventures of Cyclops and Phoenix, I believe in our YouTube video, we refer to him as like Joffrey Baratheon, like he's Joffrey Cable. There's a part of me that so much wants the shitty King Joffrey strife, having to deal with or live in a world with Kid Cable having good parents and a sister Rachel, and just like dark version of Cable and all of that, and how that dynamic would be like. But I also want old man strife, who's been through all of this and fought all the wars against, you know, old Cable, now seeing young Cable thrive and young Cable's role, and how he, like, there's just so many things that I want from this. Like, I want both of them at the same time. And so I was super, super excited for all the possibilities and what we get to see from Strife in the future, because the Strife Cable dynamic of Adventures of Cyclops and Phoenix, in terms of what that means, and God, can you imagine this Strife, who grew up in the future, raised by Apocalypse to be his heir and to be seeking his approval and to be the next, you know, great one, when he finds out that Apocalypse went into battle in fucking Otherworld with this kid Cable and fought by his side instead, like, oh man, like, there's just gonna be some, like, yeah, I want all of this. This is exciting for me.
I have exactly the same reaction, essentially. I can't tell what I want more. An adult Strife being like, I'm an old man and you are a child. I should be able to kick you down these stairs. Or if I want Strife being like, you know, Cable, I always want everything you have, and to turn himself into a kid. I don't know which one I want more. Maybe I want two Strifes running around and just one Cable. I don't know, but I am having a very strong reaction to this. However, I do have one thing to say, and it's certainly not a commentary on the art, because the art is stunning and powerful and dramatic, and it does everything it's supposed to do. But guys, I want someone to get a message to Strife immediately, and that's, bro, stop skipping leg day. Oh no, is it too expensive to upgrade the armor, so you've got to skip leg day? But that's a lot of skips, man.
Maybe he's spending all of his energy on holding his head up with that giant helmet.
I was literally about to say, I hope you're gonna say neck day.
Yeah, neck day.
He definitely needs to do some calf raises.
Or he's got to have the world's strongest core to move that metal leg work. Like, I can't even, and I actually do love that. I think, you know, there's some characters that their headpiece is kind of silly. I've made this joke a few times that the Juggernaut has no need for peripheral vision because he's unstoppable. It's okay that he can't see to the side. Sure. And that Galactus is so big, it's just so much purple and pink, you just can't help but deal with it. You know what I mean? I feel like Strife's headwear is getting, like, solid gold levels of lunacy.
Strife's headwear is essential for two reasons. One, it immediately tells us who he is. Like, there have been multiple issues and covers and scenes just like this where you see that headpiece and you know it's Strife. This goes back to Executioner's Song, goes back to
I'm here for 74. I think it's necessary.
It's doubly necessary because when you take the mask off, he looks just like fucking Cable, and then you don't know which one it is, if it's Strife or Cable.
Yeah.
You need the mask so you know it's not Cable.
If you only saw their legs, you'd be confused, because right now they have the same size legs.
We would all be super confused if he wasn't wearing the mask. We'd be like, oh shit, is old man Cable time traveled back and fucking with Kid Cable now? Like, before Kid Cable killed him? Like, what happened?
Well, that's actually the promise that I think we are due from this setup. I think we're going to see some version of Strife being like, I'm old man Cable and I'm back. And everybody be like, genetically, you are old man Cable. And Krakoa's going to be like, no, I'm going to spit you out. And
Hope is going to be so fucked up over that. That is gonna fuck with Hope so hard.
And that might even be part of why you would, I guess, ultimately, to answer my own question, why you would want to keep Cable in a position to be on Sword in a lot of ways, like get him out of the Krakoan area. I think if you're going to be playing with the idea of Strife infiltrating using the same face, having Cable off world is going to make that a lot easier to do.
That really does make sense. So did either of you find it interesting that this Order of X leader isn't a naturally born human? He's a clone, from what it looks like. He dropped out of one of those tubes. That's why he's sitting on the floor naked. The same Strife reveal page.
Oh! I hadn't seen it that way. I saw him as on the floor, but you know what? He's naked and wet.
Yeah.
There's clone facilities behind him.
I was too busy dealing with my strife boner to recognize that we're in like a Sinister style cloning facility, and that is my bad. But now that I'm looking at it again, Nico, if we're all looking at the same page, do you see the old school Apocalypse A in Strife's armor?
That's all I've been thinking. That his belt is straight up. Well, if Apocalypse
that is his daddy's belt,
look, then that I'm going to steal it.
That is his daddy's belt.
Oh man, I love that catch, Kyle. Wow, that's really transformative in a lot of ways for me, because I had just been sort of dismissing this character as, you know, oh, he's just a dude that's there. It's kind of whatever. But like, to take a look
at... Humans are stupid. I don't care about them.
Yeah, the humans of X-Men tend to be kind of useless, so I don't...
Even in the real world, humans are stupid.
Yeah, they are. So I loved the Blam page. I loved the Rachel being psychic page. I love the Strife page. And that last page reveal, when Cable's like, I just need to change my luck, you say. I know. Hey, I don't know if this is going to be weird for you, but... And Domino is like, it's going to be weird as hell. Let's do it.
You're not going to believe this, but I have some thoughts and feels about that last page.
I can't help but imagine that you might.
I am so nervous. I mentioned before that, like, okay, so I have a lot of nervous, excited combo about this. And it's not fair to Duggan, because not only has he done such a great job with characters in this book, but he has shown himself to be one of the best non-female writers of female characters working today. Like, someone I'd put up there with like Curtis Wiebe and his work on Rat Queens, in terms of like writing multiple female characters and giving them agency and making them different and unique and having different wants and needs and backgrounds and having none of it have to do with the bullshit of men. And so it's not fair to him that I have these fears or apprehensions about how he's going to use Domino. But part of me really, 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 really wants Gail Simone to have been the writer of next issue and to have like the Gail Simone Domino as someone who is capable of like being platonically maternal to Kid Nate, knowing that the man that she used to be with needs something different from her and being grateful that she's able to like repay those past slash future favors and like give that to him. And I am so, 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 so nervous that Domino and Kid Cable is going to become a sexy thing. And that would be so, 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 so creepy and bad. And I just like, I really hope it doesn't go there. And I think that's like, it can be so good, but man, I know like I could list about 20 writers off the top of my head that without a doubt would fuck up the next issue so hard.
I mean, I have to imagine that Domino is going to work very hard to make sure that Kid Cable does not turn into the adult Cable she was romantically with. She knows that man's pain better than anyone. She knows his torture, his inability to sleep at night, his fear, his worry, the anxiety of just being alive and being that Cable. I think Domino is going to do everything she can to ensure that this Cable never becomes the man that she was romantically entangled with. And I think in a lot of ways that's good, because that gives Domino the opportunity to come out from behind Cable's shadow. Not that she's really still there, but a lot of people culturally don't understand her as a different enough character from Cable's sidekick. So I'm very much in the mindset of, if this is an introduction to another older sister character, or perhaps a cool aunt, your cool aunt that, you know, gives you a beer one time and like, you know, introduces.
Yes, she can give him a beer. Cool Aunt Nina can give him a beer, just no bathtubs.
I loved how often Doug kind of popped in the background in this issue, especially considering how he was non-existent in the post Ten of Swords New Mutants.
Yeah.
And
he goes wherever Bay goes.
He does.
Where Bay go, Dougie follow.
And on the page right before that Domino splash page, the second panel, who's that guy with the mohawk? He looks familiar. That's not Kid Gladiator, is it?
It looks a little like Kid Gladiator, but I don't think, like, I kind of had that same thought. Like, I don't think it is, but it could be.
I really want that to be Prince Kubark. it kind of has to be headcanon. That's Prince Kubark. I want to point out the person behind Domino on the final splash page in front of Doug has white hands and a blue face.
Oh, yeah. Maybe gloves.
Skin colored gloves.
I don't know.
Hey everybody, Nico here one last time, and I love this next segment. Anytime Rod, Raven, and Robbie get together, the conversation is incredible, and the union has been sort of a interesting item on our agenda. There's a mutant in it, so of course we're covering it, and the union, Union Jack and Captain Britain have a relationship, so we want to pay some respect to our UK hero friends, right? And there's a sort of sense of disconnect from the X-Books proper, because it's a mutant that we don't really know appearing in this title. But Raven, Robbie, and Rod take the title and give it an X-Pac level examination and discussion in a way that left me, someone who read the book, even more excited about what's to come after hearing their thoughts on it. As always, guys, don't forget, guys, we recently launched our awesome new YouTube channel where you guys can find videos in the same vein as the content here, but maybe a little bit more in depth and with images. Don't forget, you guys can check out our amazing new Patreon available over on our Twitter at X is for Podcast, so you can find out how you can get in on picking some of the content going forward, maybe even get in on an episode as well. Until next week, guys, keep it Krakowin, and we'll see ya.
Hi, welcome to the next segment of X's for Pod. I am Rod. You can find me at Rod, the on Twitter and Instagram. And today I have with me Raven.
Hey, I'm Raven, a.k.a. Dame Red Bento. Feel free to find me all over the internets, but especially on Twitter, where I like post my art. And today we also have Robbie with us.
Hey, everyone. I am Robbie, and you can find me at H of Polaris on Twitter.
Awesome. We have everybody today. And today we're talking about The Union, issue number 2. And it's also has a King in Black tie-in with it. Mm-hmm. And it's by Paul Grice is the writer. And Andrea D. Vito is the penciler. Labu Underwood is the inker. Nolan Woodrow is the colorist. And then VC's Travis Lanham is the letterer.
Yes. Yay.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, The Union, if you're listening to this and you haven't read it yet, The Union is basically a newly formed superhero group that is trying to bring Britain together by forming together. We haven't really seen any of these heroes before. I think Union Jack's been in a thing before, but not this version of Union Jack. But all these, the rest of these characters are new, and we kind of got introduced to them in the first issue, but not really. The second issue is more,
gets a little bit more in depth.
Yeah, more in depth with them. So first, let's go, Raven. What did you think of this issue so far?
I felt it was an interesting issue, and as we got to get to know these new heroes from all over the UK, I kind of questioned whether they were supposed to be good guys or bad guys, because some of the way they acted and interacted with regular humans seemed to be a bit different than most traditional heroes that we've been introduced to. So maybe they're more of an anti-hero group rather than just a pure good Boy Scout-ish type hero group.
Yeah, I could definitely see that. Maybe like the Thunderbolts of Britain. Maybe.
See that.
What about you, Robbie? What did you think of this issue number 2 so far?
So I like it, but
it's hard to explain, right?
It is hard to explain.
Yeah, like I like the characters, but I don't know if I like the story.
Mm-hmm. And I know this book was supposed to be first introduced in Empire. But, you know, coronavirus pandemic happened and they got pushed back, and now it's being introduced now, but with the King in Black tie-in instead. So I don't know if that, you know, has truly affected the story, because maybe they were trying to go a different way with the invasion and everything. But this is an invasion too, but kind of like two different kinds of invasions.
Yeah.
So maybe it would have felt better with the Empire invasion instead of the King in Black one. Maybe it would have flowed more. Not that this has like a terrible flow, but it's just very different. Yeah.
Yeah, and I do wonder if we had been British and knew about a lot of British politics, if we would also think of a lot of the commentary differently.
True. Very, very true.
Yeah. That's why I kept pretty much like a open mind about this whole book. So I was like, well, I'm not British. I've never been to Britain. I know a little bit about British politics, but not enough to write a page about. So I was like, well, maybe I'll learn some things. But in this issue, we do start off with Choir running from the police. We don't really know. We never find out in this issue why she's running from the police. Maybe we'll find that out later. Mm. Assuming she's, I guess, some kind of criminal. Mm-hmm. But like I said, it was 10 months ago before the main superhero that's running this group.
Britannia.
Mm-hmm. I do like Britannia's outfit. Yeah. It's really like old-ish kind of comics.
Right.
Like old style. And I kind of find that refreshing. Like, yeah. I like the bright colors and everything.
She has almost a Captain America feel with her attitude. Like, mm-hmm. Hey, let's do this together. And just trying to keep it kind of upbeat. But at the same point in time, she will get down to business. Like, you know, okay, we got shit to do. Boop, doot, doot. Let's do this. So, yeah, that was a really interesting way to bring them in, especially with Choir. She's like, hey, how about I help you help yourself kind of thing. So, yeah, that was interesting.
And with her, I do wonder if like her death would have made more of an impact to the reader had she been a character that we had known from like other books. Like, say theoretically, if she was on like the Avengers for like 2 years and we kind of knew about her a little bit more, if like her death would kind of be like more impactful, because if it seems to be impactful for the characters, but not really us so much.
Even if she'd had like a tie-in with like Excalibur or some crossover somewhere else, like, I think I would have been more invested. But also there's definitely a running political commentary kind of theme in here, because you are getting characters from like North Ireland and Wales and, you know, other parts of the UK. I think there's some subtext that we might be missing out on because we're not British and we don't necessarily know British politics.
Which I'm fine if I'm missing an aspect of the story, because I'm fine with the story, you know, educating me as the story goes on, you know, as we get more issues, maybe we'll get more educated on it. And like I said, with Marvel, I want more international books. I don't want books just in America. Getting this, I'm like giving it the space to grow, especially since it already kind of got screwed over because of the pandemic. So it's like, they're trying to find their footing. The first few issues might seem, for lack of a better word, jumbled up. It's not really jumbled up, but, you know, it's...
They're a little bit different out of our...
A little bit different. Yeah, a little bit different. So as we go on, we go to we go back to the now, which we see, you know, Britannia dead. Like you said, Robbie, we don't really feel... I feel sad because I would like to see more of this character. I hope that they do bring her back some kind of way, because, you know, heroes always kind of return for the most part. But I don't have a deep emotional connection, which I don't think we're really supposed to. I mean, we don't really know the character. They know we don't really know the character. So I think we're supposed to feel like... What's going to happen? How does Britain feel about like their Captain America, quote unquote, you know, dying?
Mm-hmm. Well, and then so much of the responsibility for the team is then placed on Union Jack. Mm-hmm. And he's like the one human. He's just, you know, he's a top level athlete. He's been doing this for a couple of years now with just grit and determination, where everybody else on the team has some sort of mutation or superpower or magic or something to that effect. Mm-hmm. And I honestly really kind of like Union Jack. He was very personable in the kind of hero that you could like get into on a base level, because he is human and he's like, he's doing his best, and hey, come on guys, let's do this. And you know, he is trying his best to manage a superpowered team, being the only person without superpowers.
Yeah.
So, like, he's had to put some of the members in check before, going, hey dude, you're killing this person, knock it off, because we're being recorded. Hello.
It's like, so, don't kill people.
Don't murder fellow, you know, personnel, because that's not going to look good.
Right. And the one thing I really do love about this book is the character designs. Like, that's what made me really excited about this book before I even read it, was like seeing all the character designs. They look really cool. They don't look like characters we've seen before, for the most part. They might be taking some designs from other characters, but they look different.
Yeah.
And
like Kelpie's design, I am in love with her design 100%. You know, her design alone, she has potential to be a gay icon.
Definitely.
100%. You know, she would be that little water demon that would fight for gay rights. We all know.
Right?
Oh my God. And she's insanely powerful.
Oh, yeah.
Crap. Yeah, an Irish water demon or Irish nope horse.
Yeah, we don't see a lot of demons outside of like the Ghost Rider books anyway, or like Doctor Strange, I guess. But this was cool. I didn't expect her to be a demon, and I was like, "Ooh, this makes me even more excited about her." Because I'm like, "What will that entail? We have demons on this team."
Yeah, and you know, just that little bit alone, it really makes me want to like research to see if this is some type of like Scottish like mythology type of thing.
Kelpie is.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. A Kelpie is a water horse, but they don't tend to be well intentioned. They tend to be kind of cranky. They're not the worst nope horse in legend, but they're not polite. They're not diplomatic. They are scary and they are powerful, and that's kind of why I liked when they showed her almost killing somebody in the first issue. I'm like, yeah, no. If this is what I think it is, yeah, it's a demon. Oh. Yeah, no, yeah, she would murder him.
I love that. I don't want her to kill people, obviously. But I love that that we get that perspective of them, and it's actually following the culture. I'm like, see, this is what I want out of this book, and this is why I'm excited for more, because I just learned something that I did not know because of this comic book. Like, that's wonderful.
Yeah, absolutely. Snakes is apparently another person on the team who is also not a mutant nor human.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be really interesting to see what Snakes does beyond being just absolutely massive and super freaking strong and just like quiet and angry in the background.
Are they a bunch of snakes in a bodysuit? Like, is that why they're called snakes? That would be interesting. Or maybe they have like a snake head. I don't know.
They're all the snakes that Saint Patrick banished from Ireland.
Oh my God. Like, what if though? What if they had to be like, oh, we don't like Ireland because, because of Saint Patrick. I don't know. That would be so cool. Like, we have, you know, we brought Saint Patrick into the comic books.
Right.
We brought the lore.
Exactly. Yeah. It feels like they are going into the lore of the UK.
Mm.
And that's interesting. That is something that is drawing me in more, because I do know a little bit of mythos and lore and that kind of thing. So I'm just like, okay, what direction are they going with this? Because I need to know.
And then we have another appearance of Choir, and you know, she didn't really do nothing until like they like basically get on top of her, and then she is basically Banshee or a siren with her screams, except you know, she dresses like Chamber. So
it seems like her power, instead of being like an outside force, unless she really like uses it to affect the outside world, it seems like she can center her power inside people, which is scary as hell.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely, definitely. And I like her nullified design better than her actual design. She looks so cool. I was like, ooh, you look like an action figure that I want.
But no, you're right on that. Like, I like her design that they had for her costume. But yeah, the nullified version looked even better. And her interaction with the null was interesting, because I think it's one of the first times we see somebody lean into it rather than try and pull away from it.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you bring that up. Yes, that is definitely something I'm glad we see, because that's something we see a lot with like symbiotic relationships, or like relations with like symbiotes that are in this Marvel universe, is when they pick people to merge with that are, you know, down and out or like really depressed or something to that nature, like not 100% well, they kind of become codependent on the symbiote because it makes them feel whole. Like, it makes them feel better. It makes them feel like they're powerful enough to beat away the sadness and just not have to deal with it or acknowledge it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's not healthy. Like, the symbiotes are not healthy. No.
Darwin.
Mm-hmm. Darwin.
So, yeah, it was interesting that they brought along a prime minister and a captain of industry, basically, the tech guy. They brought them along with them, basically, on the mission. I'm just like, well, that MP is probably going to die.
Right? I was like, this doesn't seem like a great idea. And I like how Snakes and basically calls Union Jack useless because... Yeah. He doesn't have powers.
Right. Well, like, and he got like knocked out by the...
It was a nullified choir. Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. She punched him real hard. He was like, knocked out.
Yeah. So, yeah. But I mean, he is human. He is not superpowered at all. So mm-hmm. Yeah, he's going to get knocked around a bit. And I don't think they had never interacted with anything else that was nullified. So he couldn't have known that she was going to be like super strong, powerful.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Oh yeah, there's no way. Being...
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no way of knowing that. But I love that he just gets he doesn't know why he gets ignored. I think they're going to touch on that because they brought it up for a reason. I don't think it's because he doesn't matter. I think there's something else about him why they didn't take him, but something mystical, maybe with the sword or something. I don't know. I feel like Marvel likes to do a lot of things with swords. So I feel like we're going to see that, especially in Britain. You know, Britain's a lot about swords, Excalibur and all that jazz. So. But I like that I like that we get to see Kelp have them ride on a wave.
Oh my God, that was so... It's like, yes, of course I can get you there, but you're probably not going to like it. Like, oh, dude. Oh, riding that big ass wave across the oceans.
Yeah, I really love them exploring more of Kelpie's abilities in this issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, it showed that she is just insanely powerful.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to know how Britannia talked Kelpie into like actually joining the team and how she got Snakes to join the team. Because, I mean, they make it quite poignant. Like, hey, the whole reason we're here is because of Britannia. So I'm like,
Oh, yeah. Like, after they get to the theme park and everything, and then, you know, sea demon. I guess sea dragon.
Kelpie.
She might turn into a dragon. We don't know. But
no horse,
right? Oh yeah, horse. That's right. She's gonna turn into a seahorse. That'd be cool to see. Basically, after she tries to drown everybody, even though there's children there, we see the children, and she's like, "You know what would be a good idea?
I need a distraction. Tsunami."
Right? Like, you meant a big wave of water, right? That's what you meant, right? That's what you meant.
Oh, holy crap!
Which basically did nothing because they still had the people after that. It didn't really help at all.
Well, I mean, that was her version of helping.
Yeah, true.
I guess
technically it did help because them bringing the prime minister and the tech guy, you know, got it for Union Jack to use a sword and electrify all of the nullified. And that's one of the weaknesses of the nullified is electricity.
Mm-hmm.
And fire. So, like, they didn't know that, but well, I guess they did because they said earlier that we didn't touch on that when they crushed the video camera, that it kind of hurt. They saw that it kind of hurt the nullified symbiote.
Yeah, and when they crushed that little floating camera, they got that electrical shock, and it did the symbiote pulled away for a little bit. So yeah, they like Union Jack is smart. He's not a slouch at all. He's very observant, as are the people around him. So yeah. He's like,
right.
So here's something we can do.
Exactly.
They were smart. They were observant, and they definitely used what they had at hand. Which I don't remember if anybody else from the King in Black series has figured out the electricity and fire thing necessarily just yet, other than Sunfire on Krakoa, who just lit one up. But yeah, like this could be a very good key piece of information going forward.
Mm-hmm.
And God, I'm I'm trying to think of who else uses electricity, but finding out that Kelpie and Snake were able to stave off attacks from the Nulled because of their very different physiognomy, because they're not human and they're not mutants.
Uh-huh.
So apparently there are some physical limitations as to what the symbiote can bind to.
Which is very interesting, because the symbiote can also combine to many different types of aliens, because at this point, Null has destroyed like 10 different planets already before he got to mm-hmm. Earth. So it's very interesting to say that he can't, you know, take over a demon. And I guess he can't take over whatever Snakes is, like a bunch of snakes. I don't know. But that is interesting. Like, these are more mystical type beings. Null mm-hmm. can't combine with them. He can't take them over because he's not in that realm, which is an interesting thing to know, you know, like that might have a factor in it as well later down the line.
Right. We might end up seeing Doctor Strange and Voodoo and some of the more mystical beings showing up, I'm guessing.
Mm-hmm. Maybe. I know. And because in the first King in Black, they have Storm because they don't know where Thor is. They have Storm because they're like, electricity hurts them. So mm-hmm. that's why they like have her. But I mean, she gets overwhelmed. Like Null takes her because it's just her. Like she's no mega level mutant, but it's taken over the whole world. She can only do so much by herself. Yeah, and then they capture Doctor Strange too, which I'm going down the line of this whole Null event. If you're reading the Null event, Black Cat is actually trying to rescue Strange because Captain America told her that they need Doctor Strange again. So that's her mission. Mm-hmm. So I think they are like doing like a whole thing of like, you know, mystics and like maybe lightning, because Thor is going to probably make an appearance, is going to like save the day, which kind of is usually what happens. So...
Right. Well, I mean, it would definitely make some sense. The god of thunder and lightning shows up and just drops the hammer, as it were.
Yeah, right. But it is interesting that Choir, like we said, is like one of the first people that we've seen in this whole event that really want to stay with Null. And mm-hmm. then she's like, Null, don't leave me. And it's just like, whoa, that girl needs some therapy.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, like to see somebody actually lean into the symbiosis versus everybody else trying to go, no, I have to resist. And she's like, no, I have to have the thing. I'm like, girl, you like them toxic relationships, don't you? Because holy hell, nobody else has been trying to lean into this. Yeah, that was ooh, that's gonna be interesting to see how that plays out. Like, is she gonna try and go back to him again?
Exactly. We see that that Britain knows that Britannia is dead now.
Yeah.
So
it's televised. Ugh.
Right. They're like, you know, our superstar is gone. We don't have her anymore. And also the rest of the team is like, you know what? We're leaving. And he's like, oh yeah, we should leave, you know, Union Jack is. And they're like, no. We're like leaving. Like, you don't understand. We're like going away.
Mm-hmm. That shit was funny as hell, because Choir was like, no, sir, do not get it twisted. We were here for Britannia, not this team, or not the mm-hmm. government.
Yeah, that was like, oh, come on, guys, don't leave now. It's like, I think you just lost your team. And the prime minister, oh my god, that little weasel. Ugh, he's like, yeah, by the way, if you don't get the team back together, we're holding you personally responsible. I'm like, what kind of dick move is that? Like, he has any say over them. Like, what the hell?
But yeah, I like that. It's very, like, you know, government bad, which, yeah. But it's very like, you know, the government doesn't look out, like a lot of the government doesn't look out for your best interest. They just want you to work for them. And mm-hmm. if you're not going to do that, well, you signed this contract, honey. You got to go to jail now. So,
right? Like, oh my God, I can't even believe that they're pulling this crap. But yeah, I can sort of believe it. Even in a time of severe crisis, they're pulling this crap.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the earth is covered in black goo, and they're like, but yeah, but you're going to go to jail because of a contract you signed. I'm like, why are we worrying about this right now?
What? But yeah, right. I mean, it kind of points to, you know, kind of a bit of government incompetence that seems to be a theme across so many countries currently.
Since the beginning of time. So I feel like this is a lesson for all the listeners. Always read the fine print before you sign anything. That's a life lesson right there.
Most definitely.